This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with writer Michelle Mushabek about the 75th anniversary of al-Nakba.
Michelle tells our listeners about the ongoing atrocities in the occupied Palestinian territory that we really don't hear much about in the corporate media.
We talk about a military training program right in our own backyard. It's called the Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps, or JROTC, and it teaches lessons to more than 500,000 students in approximately 3,400 high schools nationwide. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
And I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org. On May 15th, Palestinians marked the 75th anniversary of al-Nakba, which means the catastrophe in Arabic. On that date in 1948, Israelis ethnically cleansed nearly 750,000 Palestinians from their lands and destroyed more than 500 Palestinian towns and villages. In addition, on May 15th, for the first time ever, the United Nations General Assembly officially condemned the Nakba. May 15th was also the day that Israel and Palestinian Islamic Jihad agreed to a ceasefire brokered by Egypt to stop the violence that resulted in the deaths of 33 Palestinians and 2 Israelis. The Israeli assault on Gaza was the 6th such attack since 2007, when Israel imposed a permanent siege on Gaza, controlling the ingress and egress of Palestinians. Israel maintains an illegal occupation of Palestinian territory, and the United States enables this occupation by providing $3.8 billion in military aid to Israel every year. We are fortunate to have with us today Michelle Mushabek, who is a Palestinian-American writer, editor, translator, and musician. He is the founder and publisher of Interlink Publishing, a 36-year-old Massachusetts-based independent publishing house. Michelle wrote the article titled, "The Nakba Didn't End in 1948. It Continues to Impact Palestinians Daily," which was recently published by Truthout. Michelle Mushabek, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you, Heidi, and thank you, Marjorie, for having me on the show. It's good to be with you.
Michelle, please explain to our listeners why Palestinians continue to commemorate the Nakba. What are the conditions in the occupied Palestinian territory?
Well, let me start by saying that if someone in a pub asked me to describe my family's story in one sentence, I would say exile and starting over, exile and starting over, and exile and starting over. I would probably add a clarification that I did not repeat those words 3 times because I had too many beers. But my family's experience of multiple exiles, from Katamon in West Jerusalem in 1948, to East Jerusalem, to Beirut, to New York, it is not unique, but it's one of the many sad episodes of being Palestinians. I always tell my children that our stories of exile and displacement and injustice will live on, as will our beautiful memories of our homeland. When it comes to the Nakba on May 15, 1948, the world really witnessed one of the largest forced migrations in modern history. This date is forever etched in the collective memory of every Palestinian. And yes, the Nakba did not end in 1948. It continues to this day because of the continuation of Israel's founding strategy of the forcible removal of the indigenous population. because the horrific conditions Palestinians have to endure on a daily basis under Israel's brutal military occupation continue, because the denial of Palestinian rights to equality, freedom, and dignity also continues. My family and friends in Palestine continue to suffer daily abuses under Israel's most inhumane form of collective punishment. But, you know, worst of all, in my view, is that our government remains tacitly supportive of Israel's human rights violations, its crimes against humanity, and its ongoing oppression of Palestinians. You asked about the conditions in the occupied territories. I can tell you that the level of Palestinian despair is really at an all-time high. Palestinians continue to be colonized. Their lands continue to be confiscated for illegal settlement building. Family members continue to be separated from one another by the so-called monstrosity called the separation wall. Communities continue to be forcibly displaced, homes demolished. Palestinian farmers' olive trees, continue to be uprooted. Palestinian children continue to be terrorized and killed by Israeli defense forces. And I can go on and on. You know, even Palestinians living inside Israel and are supposed to be Israeli citizens continue to be discriminated against. And all this takes place under the watchful eye of Israel's greatest ally, the United States. So to sum up, I just want to say that Palestinians are fighting for is a just and democratic society that benefits everyone. So until Palestinians get justice, freedom, and equal rights, and until Israel adheres to international law, there can be no hope for peace. And by the way, we're not going away.
Michelle, you write that Israel maintains an apartheid regime. Can you please elaborate?
Yes, sure. Apartheid is racism at its core. It's a harsh, institutionalized system of racial segregation with policies that privilege one people over another. And in Israel, non-Jews do not have the same political and economic rights as Jews. Israel controls the area between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, and yet half the people living under Israeli control are denied equal rights. They have no say in how they want to be governed. And international human rights organizations, including Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, have issued extensive reports recently that concluded that Israel practices apartheid. Even B'Tselem, Israel's oldest human rights organization, recently said that Israel is not a democracy that has a temporary occupation attached to it. It is one regime between the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea, and we must look at the full picture and see it for what it is, apartheid. And also the International Criminal Court labeled apartheid as a crime against humanity, yet our elected officials, of course, disregard all of this.
Michelle, Israel justifies its repeated assaults on Gaza by claiming that it is acting in self-defense. Why is that an impermissible characterization?
Yes, we hear that all the time. You know, Israel does not really exercise its so-called right to self-defense when it bombs Gaza repeatedly, as some of our elected officials and the mainstream media outlets would have you believe. Israel commits mass murder and war crimes when it does that. It utilizes its military might, one of the world's most powerful and dangerously equipped army, air force, and navy, against an occupied, crowded population under a suffocating siege for over 15 years. And we Palestinians, we wonder and we ask, why hasn't the U.S. shown us the same empathy, compassion, and support and resolve that it has shown our brothers and sisters in Ukraine during their struggle to end their illegal occupation of their land? I am really very troubled by the fact that many fellow progressives, even, who speak up against the Russian occupation of Ukraine and other injustices, continue the tradition of silence when it comes to Israel.
Under a General Assembly resolution, the occupied people have a right to resist an illegal occupation.
You are absolutely right. Yeah, absolutely.
Michelle, in your article, you quote your friend in Gaza who told you, quote, "What is worse than dying in Gaza is living in Gaza." What did he mean by that?
You know, the situation in Gaza is so heartbreaking. Gaza has been called the world's largest open-air prison, and there are nearly 2 million people in Gaza, mostly refugees from 1948 and 1967. And as you mentioned in your introduction, Gaza has been under siege for over 15 years. And during this period, Israel bombed Gaza 8 times, and each time causing death, destruction, and a human tragedy of unimaginable proportions. The people of Gaza live their lives in daily fear of the next round of aerial bombardment and missiles that could rain on them from the sky at any time and destroy their homes and rip their families apart. This is really a historic injustice and must be stopped. We cannot really remain silent about Israeli crimes that deny Palestinians the right to live as equal human beings with freedom and dignity. It's so upsetting, you know, each time Israel's indiscriminate and criminal bombardment, it ends with a short-lived ceasefire, but that, because the terror from the sky has temporarily stopped, it does not mean that the terror on the ground has ended. It is not a ceasefire when Israel continues to kill Palestinians by land, sea, and air. It's not a ceasefire when Gaza remains under siege and all crossings are closed. And it's not a ceasefire until the violence and ethnic cleansing are properly addressed and halted. The humanitarian conditions in Gaza are dire. There are shortages of food, electricity, fuel, medical supplies. All this is leaving Palestinians without life-sustaining goods and services and with endless misery and hardship. That is why my friend said to me that living in Gaza is worse than dying, because living is a slow and prolonged death. Every child in Gaza suffers from PTSD as a result.
Could you also please cite some recent atrocities that Israel committed in the occupied West Bank?
I mean, there's been systemic raids in the West Bank, on Jenin, on Nablus, and other towns that killed scores of civilians. Last year, the Israeli army shot and killed over 170 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank alone, many of whom were children, and they wounded hundreds. The most alarming thing is also settler violence against Palestinians is on the rise. According to Defense for Children International, Israeli forces and settlers killed 36 children last year across the West Bank and East Jerusalem. And I recently read a report by Amnesty International that today there are 175 permanent checkpoints and blockades supported by a biometric surveillance system in the West Bank. Israeli authorities also last year demolished 952 structures across the West Bank and had administratively detained 866 Palestinians. And it's pretty horrific.
Michelle, 1 year ago, beloved Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh was assassinated by the Israeli occupying forces for reporting on Israel's illegal activities in the West Bank. Has anyone been brought to justice for her killing? And was Abu Akleh's death an isolated incident? Or do other Palestinian journalists face similar repression from Israel?
Well, of course not. No one has ever been brought to justice when a member of the IDF has killed a Palestinian, a journalist or otherwise. Palestinians the world over will never forget the assassination of Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh 1 year ago. Her murder by the IDF with a sniper bullet to the face while clearly wearing a press vest is shocking. You know, Abu Akleh dedicated her life to reporting the truth and exposing the horrors of the ongoing Israeli occupation. And she, in my view, she represented the best of Palestine and the best humanity has ever produced. You asked about other Palestinian journalists. Israel's systematic targeting of Palestinian journalists, the arrest of human rights defenders, and the shutting down of human rights organizations have been very well documented. A couple of weeks ago, the Committee to Protect Journalists issued a new report released to coincide with the anniversary of Abu Akleh's death. And the report found that since 2001, Israel has never charged or held anyone accountable for the killings of at least 20 journalists, 18 of whom were Palestinian.
My co-host Heidi Boghossian and I, Marjorie Cohn, are speaking with writer and publisher Michelle Mushabek about the ongoing Nakba in Palestine. Michelle, please tell our listeners about the recent attacks on Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the occupied Palestinian territory. Have other UN Special Rapporteurs been subjected to analogous attacks for their criticism of Israel?
The UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the occupied Palestinian territory, Francesca Albanese, has come under vicious attacks, including false accusations of anti-Semitism following her report highlighting Israeli settler colonialism and apartheid. But she is a strong person who does not succumb easily to intimidation or threats. And yes, she's not the only UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights to be subjected to attacks. I don't think I am wrong in saying that most former UN Special Rapporteurs have received some kind of harsh treatment. Former UN Special Rapporteur and friend Richard Falk, for example, a prominent international lawyer and professor at Princeton University, was even barred by the Israeli government from entering Israel when he was UN Special Rapporteur.
It's clear that Israel now has the most right-wing anti-Palestinian government in history. You write that many people in Israel's new regime favor a, quote, out-of-state solution. What is that?
You know, the two-state solution promised to Palestinians during the Oslo Accords is no longer possible. It is dead completely because of Israel's continuous colonization and de facto annexation of Palestinian land. The chances of a one-state solution with equal citizenship rights for everyone are even slimmer, since Zionists insist on keeping Israel a Jewish state with democratic rights for Jews only. So what is left, and what many in the new extremist Israeli government are in favor of, is what I'm calling the out-of-state solution. And what I mean by that is that this is a strategy that aims to transfer Palestinians or keep oppressing them until they give up and leave to neighboring Arab countries, dispossessing them of their homeland. But Palestinians are determined to keep their struggle alive. So this too, I believe, will fail.
Michelle, in 2005, Palestinian civil society issued a call for boycott, divestment, and sanctions. And people around the world have responded, so much so that Israel considers the BDS movement an existential threat. Could you please tell our listeners what the BDS movement entails?
Sure. Inspired by the South African anti-apartheid movement, the BDS movement is a nonviolent global initiative that works to end international support for Israel's oppression of Palestinians and pressure Israel to comply with international law. BDS advocates for boycotting Israeli and international companies engaged in violations of Palestinian human rights. It also calls for the divestment and has initiated many campaigns that urge banks, churches, universities, and the like to withdraw investments from the State of Israel and companies that sustain Israeli apartheid. And BDS also aims to pressure governments to fulfill their legal obligations to end Israeli apartheid by imposing sanctions. I can add that while it's hard for Palestinians to not feel helpless when they are subjected to these massive injustices for so long, they have shown tremendous resilience and are inspired by the collective support of people in the global community, and especially the many, many gains achieved by the growing boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement known as BDS.
Although the U.S. government continues to unconditionally support Israel's illegal policies, there has been some recent pushback in the U.S. Congress. Can you please explain?
Sure. You're correct in saying that this administration, like those before it, continues to shield Israel from accountability for its violations of international law and enables its settler colonialism and apartheid by providing it with billions of dollars in military funding. Congress's really deafening silence and its fear of criticizing the Israeli government makes it complicit in the ongoing suffering of Palestinians. Congress has become Israel's top enabler of its crimes of apartheid and the main stepping stone in the Palestinians' quest for freedom, equality, and human rights. But having said this, you are also correct in saying that the discourse is changing. Our activism is working, and our representatives are beginning to listen. A recent Gallup poll concluded that now the Democrats' sympathies lie more with the Palestinians than the Israelis, 49% versus 38%. And the magnitude of global solidarity with the Palestinians shows that people, especially the younger generation, are no longer looking away. But while the discourse has changed enormously on the public level, the change has not yet been matched on the part of our elected officials. But we are definitely seeing signs of some pushback. And I can give you a few examples. Recently, Representative Betty McCollum and 16 co-sponsors have introduced a bill prohibiting Israel from using U.S. aid to detain Palestinian children, destroy Palestinian homes, or unilaterally annex Palestinian land. And this is an important bill that was introduced before, but Betty McCollum continues to reintroduce it again and again. Another example would be on May 15th, the 75th anniversary of the Nakba, Kevin McCarthy blocked Representative Rashida Tlaib from hosting an event at Capitol commemorating the Nakba. But despite McCarthy's attempt, the event went ahead anyway. It was moved to a Senate office room thanks to Senator Bernie Sanders, who was able to secure a new venue in the Senate office building where McCarthy has no jurisdiction.
Michelle, what can our listeners do to pressure the U.S. government to stop enabling the illegal Israeli occupation?
I would say don't stop the protests and don't stop putting pressure on our elected officials. You know, we must really intensify our call on Congress and the Biden administration to stop funding Israeli apartheid, racism, and oppression of Palestinians. I would also add, arm yourself with the necessary tools and information that would allow you to engage in critical thinking and informed debate and be able to argue in favor of justice and equality. Sign petitions that call for Palestinian rights to freedom and equality. But most importantly, stay informed, read the alternative press, Mondo Wise, Electronic Intifada, etc., your show. Join organizations such as Jewish Voice for Peace, Adala, American Friends Service Committee, and others, and read books by Palestinians. Can I pitch a book here?
Yes, go right ahead.
I'm the publisher, as you said, at Interlink Publishing, and we have just published a book called Palestine Hijacked, How Zionism Forged an Apartheid State from River to Sea. It's a meticulously researched book about the 1948 period by Tom Suarez that I would highly recommend.
Michelle, in interests of full disclosure, Interlink, your publishing company, published my most recent book on drones and targeted killing. So thank you for that.
And Michelle, we understand that your daughter has just published a book inspired by you. What is it called and what is it about?
Yes, I'm super proud of my daughter, Hannah. Her book is called Homeland, My Father Dreams of Palestine. It was just published in March by San Francisco's Chronicle Books, and the publisher has already gone into a second printing, so I'm thrilled about that. It retells a bedtime story I used to tell my kids when they were little about my childhood in the old city of Jerusalem, about my walks with my grandfather. You know, I was 11 years old, just before the 67 war, when I last saw my grandparents. It was also the last time I saw Jerusalem. So the picture book, it has universal appeal. It's an endearing, lovely story of immigration, memory, and familial love.
Well, Michelle Mushabek, thank you so much for your inspiring and informative comments and for being with us today on Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you very much for having me, Marjorie and Heidi.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The Junior Reserve Officers Training Corps, or JROTC, is a federal program sponsored by the U.S. Armed Forces in high schools across the nation. It currently teaches its lessons to more than 500,000 students in approximately 3,400 high schools. In recent years, the military and its supporters have promoted the idea of a significant increase in the number of high schools with JROTC. One proposal even calls for expanding up to 6,000. Because of this, one nonprofit in San Diego decided it was time to examine the textbooks used in JROTC classes to see exactly what they're teaching. The Project on Youth and Non-Military Opportunities, or Project YANO, is a counter-recruitment organization founded in 1984. It released its findings of the textbooks in early July.
Reviewers have backgrounds in classroom teaching or education activism, or special knowledge of subjects that JROTC claims to address, including civil rights, violence prevention, leadership methods, and world history. Reviewer team members included current and retired high school teachers, military veterans, and a documentary film producer. Joining us to talk about this report and JROTC in general is Rick Jankow, a co-founder and board member of Project Yano. Rick worked for 34 years as the organization's full-time program coordinator. He's researched and organized around the issues of military recruiting, high school, junior ROTC, and the general militarization of K-12 schools. Rick, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Rick, tell us in a nutshell, what is the militarization of youth and what's wrong with it?
In basic terms, I would say it's a situation where young people are militarized by conditioning them to see military values and behavior as normal and an acceptable model for civilian society. That's done many different ways, but that's sort of the basic way I would define it. And the reason it's wrong is that the values taught by the military system emphasize obedience to authority and the use of violence to resolve conflict, which is the opposite of what we should be teaching young people if we want them to think critically and uphold democratic ideals.
Now, the JROTC website says, and I'm quoting, that it's one of the largest character development and citizenship programs for youth in the world. What promises does JROTC make to young people?
I'll list several. Realize there are problems with all of these promises, though. One thing they promise is leadership skills and values education. They promise self-discipline. They promise to teach lessons in history and social studies. They claim that it provides academic improvement for the cadets. They claim that it improves eligibility for college acceptance. They say that it will provide access to college scholarships. Those are sort of the main promises that one can hear from them.
Would you say that students who are attracted to some of those promises, do they join ROTC of their own free will most of the time?
I'm not sure how often it's voluntary. Yes, some do join because they want to be in the program. They see it as a way to advance their prospects for joining the military later on. But we've also seen plenty of evidence of schools involuntarily placing students in the program. And the reason for that is mostly because federal law requires a minimum enrollment level in order for a school to have the program. And so placing students in involuntarily is one way to meet that minimum requirement.
And let's just be clear, this is for both boys and girls in school.
That's true.
Now, why does the military and some supporters want to expand JROTC programs in high schools?
Well, I think it's mostly because of the recruitment function. They publicly will promise that JROTC is not a recruiting program. This is said by instructors in the program and school officials. But testimony in Congress has labeled it as the military's most effective in-school recruiting program. And according to the different military branches that sponsor JROTC, between 30% and 40% of students who finish multiple years in the program eventually do enter the military. And the textbooks are full of recruitment information telling students, you know, how to join the military. So it's really quite disingenuous for anybody to claim it's not a recruiting program.
And I was interested to learn and a bit surprised that JROTC instructs students on the use of weapons. Is that accurate?
It's often offered as a voluntary option. Students who join JROTC would have to choose to be on the rifle team. But marksmanship training is done with high-powered lead pellet rifles and shooting ranges that are frequently located in the schools. Some school shootings, in fact, have been carried out by current or former JROTC cadets, and in the case of the Parkland, Florida shooting, the shooter was actually a former JROTC cadet who learned his marksmanship in the JROTC program there.
Interesting that we don't hear about that in the news coverage of these mass shootings.
We hear very little of it.
Oh, Rick, tell us about Project YANO and why it formed.
It formed in 1984 to address the socioeconomic factors that make low-income youth especially vulnerable to recruitment and militarization, and also for the purpose of facilitating greater youth activism around the issues that directly affect them. And it was formed with the involvement of military veterans, where we see ourselves as sort of an educational organization that can help young people make more educated decisions about their futures. And we realize that when it comes to military recruitment, the burden falls disproportionately on low-income youth and youth of color.
Rick, have you encountered any legal issues when you do counter-recruitment and school demilitarization organizing?
Yes, there are several ways that legal issues come up. There is, for example, a legal issue around schools giving the military's aptitude test, the ASVAB, which stands for Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery. Recruiters basically go to the counseling staff and convince them that they can give this free test to their students to help them evaluate their career prospects. And the test results in recruiters receiving not only contact information, but also very personal information on the students who take the test. And some schools have even made it mandatory that an entire grade of students take the test. The Federal Privacy Act that affects the release of pupil records, we believe, is violated by the test. And we wish that it could be litigated, but so far we've had no opportunity for that because we haven't really found the ideal plaintiff to file a lawsuit. But we worked with the Rutgers Center for Law and Justice to research the issue, and they produced a best practices memo that explains how the test violates privacy and is actually a nice piece for distributing to counseling staff at schools. Another issue has been junior ROTC, and what comes up there is there's a federal statute that requires disestablishment of a JROTC unit when the minimum enrollment is not met, and the minimum enrollment is 100 students or 10% of the student body. We've seen many cases of JROTC units that fall below the minimum requirement, but they continue to operate in the school. And here, where we're based in San Diego, we actually help members of the Latinx community pressure a principal into removing a unit for under enrollment, but it took quite a bit of effort to do that. The principal just did not want to let go. We're also aware of another school in the county here that got rid of it voluntarily, and usually when that happens, the students are the ones who've actually determined that it was going to leave because they stop enrolling in it or they even boycott it. what we would like to see is activists pay attention to that and investigate enrollment numbers, because they could do something similar if they can document that the federal law has been violated when the unit is allowed to survive without having the minimum enrollment. And in fact, we worked with the National Lawyers Guild Military Law Task Force on that issue, and the task force produced a very nice memorandum on the statute, and it's another way that students and parents and others could pursue the issue in their local school.
Was Kathy Gilbert involved in that?
She was involved to the extent of referring us to an attorney in Albuquerque, I think it was, who actually is the one who did the work.
Great. Okay. We love the Military Law Task Force. Rick, I understand that you actually advised on a lawsuit in the 1980s that resulted in establishing the right of counter-recruitment activists to have equal access to schools as do military recruiters. Can you tell us about that case?
Yes, that is the other instance where legal issues have come up, and in fact, it's probably the most frequent issue. What happened is in the early 1980s, a San Diego organization was banned from placing ads in student newspapers, and the organization went to federal court seeking an injunction. The argument they made was based on the First and 14th Amendments and utilized the Supreme Court's government forum analysis. The organization lost at the district court level, but then appealed in the Ninth Circuit, basically reversed the district court. And the ruling held that the subject of military service is controversial in nature, not primarily economic, and that once a forum on such a controversial issue is created by a school, it must give equal access to those giving opposite views on the subject. There were, I think, a total of 5 lawsuits during the 1980s, all of which were eventually decided in favor of counter-recruitment groups. The scope of access granted differed in each case, but they all were positive results. And it turned out that the Ninth Circuit ruling established the broadest range for equal access. And we've used it to basically force school districts to grant access, and other groups have used it as well. The ACLU has cited it frequently when they have assisted organizations that have had access issues, and in most cases, by citing those particular lawsuits, but especially the Ninth Circuit, a local grassroots group can prevail. And we've tried to make ourselves in Project Yano available to advise them on ways to do that. The problem with that is that there is a tendency by some groups to want to litigate again. And based on the climate, the political climate, especially at the Supreme Court level, we would discourage further litigation anytime in the foreseeable future. The military tried to intervene in our case in San Diego. They did intervene in a case in Atlanta, and they stated that they did so primarily because then they could offer resources for appeal to the Supreme Court that a school district might not have. It turned out that they did not really help defeat groups from getting access in those cases. But they also made it clear that they're going to be looking for future similar cases and then seek to intervene in those.
The reason to discourage litigation, especially now, is that we don't want to create bad law and undo all the work that you did in the wonderful victory from the 80s.
That's exactly the point, yes.
Rick, let's turn to the recent Project Yano textbook report. I understand reviewers had several concerns. One was that the textbooks failed to acknowledge that members of the military are often sent to fight non-defensive wars of choice, frequently for the purpose of advancing U.S. economic and political power. In that instance, what false assumption about joining the military does it reinforce?
One motivation for many who enlist is the assumption that our military is only a defensive force that protects our freedoms. And the textbooks reinforce that myth with the kinds of lessons that you described, telling students basically this is how you'll be able to support freedom in your country and defend us from aggression and from enemies abroad. And it's basically reinforcing that myth that that is what you achieve when you join the military. In fact, it's not. In fact, you'd be sent to places to fight wars of aggression.
For the most part, is the material contained in these textbooks up to date? And also, do different branches of the military contribute to these books?
The most of the material is way out of date. The Army, in fact, during the last school year, was still using a 2005 version of their core textbooks for their remote learning program. And yes, every branch determines its own curriculum. They all either produce the books themselves or they hire writers and textbook publishers to create the material for them, and then sometimes they will take existing standard textbooks and customize them for JROTC. So each military branch can brand it according to their own characteristics.
I know this is a complex analysis, but how, in general, do the JROTC textbooks compare to standard school books?
Well, for one thing, standard school books don't contain entire sections teaching students how to join the military. They don't teach military values and military leadership. One of our reviewers, who's a recently retired social studies teacher, actually was able to compare the contents of a standard civics textbook with content that JROTC had borrowed from it and modified. And what she found was that there were questions that had been posed in the original standard book to encourage critical thinking by students, and those questions were turned instead into declarative statements by JROTC. So they weren't really asking students to think critically about a particular question, they were just telling them what to think.
And that dovetails with something you said earlier about JROTC instilling respect for authority as well as other qualities that are taught in the military. Did your reviewers find examples of racism in the JROTC textbooks?
Oh, yes. One textbook referred to the genocide waged against Native peoples in the U.S. and in the Americas as the quote-unquote Indian problem. It also quoted a general who called them savages. Another book quoted a U.S. admiral who used a racist stereotype aimed at Asians. He referred to the cunning of a female Viet Cong. Another book had a section on the Middle East, and it dismissively and incorrectly claimed that most, and they used the term Arabic, which is incorrect. That's a language, but the book claimed that most Arabic countries are under some form of Islamic Sharia law, and then it compared that to the many more countries that are based on the European Civil Code. There are other examples of that, especially in the treatment of Native Americans in the wars that were waged against them in the 1800s. it's not unusual. We saw some of those examples of racism and misinformation about history in a review of the books that we did back in the late 1990s. So it was not a total shock, at least to me, that we found more of that.
Are the teachers, the instructors who use these textbooks, are they part of the military, or are they the high school, part of the high school faculty?
They're both. They're employed by the school district, and the school district's required to give them all the benefits that are given to a regular teacher, but the military has to vet them, and they must be retired officers or retired commissioned officers. So that's a basic part of the statute that authorizes the JROTC program. They rarely have teaching credentials in the subjects that they're teaching other than military-related topics. And this has led to a lot of criticism and challenges from community activists, but school districts seem to be willing to look the other way when it's pointed out that these are instructors that are teaching subjects that they are not really qualified to teach. And the military actually recognized it was a potential problem for them when a few years ago they began to require at a minimum an associate arts degree, because there were JROTC instructors who had no college degree who were teaching these subjects in the classroom. So now at least they have to have an AA, but that doesn't mean that they have credentials to teach history or civics or social studies.
Rick, how is this textbook review project, how is the report going to be used in terms of organizing and for activist purposes?
Well, we have a couple of goals. One is that we want to bring it to the attention of journalists and op-ed writers who focus on education issues. And secondly, we want to offer it to activists as a possible tool they could use to challenge the establishment of new JROTC units in their local schools. It's a very daunting challenge to get rid of an existing unit, and in fact we suggest looking for other things to do about existing units, like try to eliminate involuntary enrollment. But it is possible to challenge a proposal to bring in the program for the first time, and it can be done so by challenging whether or not the curriculum has been vetted by the school district. That is one tool the report is that could be used for that purpose.
I'm curious, do you have any anecdotal or other information about parents' knowledge of involuntary enrollment and any reactions by families?
Yes. When we joined a coalition to demand restrictions on JROTC in the San Diego Unified School District, one thing that happened as a result of that was parents were learning for the first time not only about the shooting ranges that existed in San Diego schools, but also that their students were being forced to attend the program. And we asked students and parents to describe to us their experiences when they found out their students were enrolled, and many of them didn't know that they could demand that their students be transferred out. And in some cases, they did request a transfer, and they were told at the local school site level that there's no room for them in other classes. And in particular, they were told that this was their PE class, basically, and PE had no room for them. So parents got quite frustrated. They joined us in protests, both outside and inside the school district headquarters, and had a powerful influence over the school board, and the school board did decide, for example, to remove shooting ranges from 11 schools. The superintendent at that time issued a directive saying that students should not be allowed to enroll in JROTC without first obtaining informed consent from both the parent and the student. But what we found was that quite often parents were just shocked. They weren't really aware of what was behind the whole thing and what they could do about it.
Rick, I think that in general, this topic really screams out for more national media coverage. Most Americans would be shocked, I think, to learn about the extent of the JROTC programs and the repercussions they have.
Yeah, I think there's a particular danger that concerns me most, and that should concern not just people who are worried about the issues of war and militarism and the military-industrial complex, but it's the fact that a program like this is trying to convince students that military leadership models and values are suitable for civilian society. And that, to me, is the most dangerous feature of the military's intervention in the school system. They're trying to recruit bodies, but they're also trying to recruit minds. And they reach a lot of students who will never join the military, but who are groomed to at least think along military lines.
Good point. Rick, how can our listeners read this incredible report and learn more about Project Jano's work?
They can visit our website, which is projectjano.org. They can look us up on Facebook and Instagram. And if they check out those platforms, they can learn about some of the resources we've produced to not only help educate young people, but also to assist organizers.
Rick John Coe, it was just a pleasure to have you on to learn about JROTC and JROTC in general, but also the textbook report and the fine work of Project Jano. We want to stay in touch, and we wish you all the best of luck.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate this.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.